Welcome to What If, the Futures Legal Podcast.
I'm Hasti.
And I'm Rana.
Every episode, we ask a bold what if question and explore how law might evolve to meet the future.
From AI to space and everything in between, we explore how law, policy, and society adapt when the future arrives faster than we expect.
Because every what if brings us one step closer to the future of law.
Let's get started. Hi everyone, welcome back to What If, the Futures Legal Podcast. Or if you're new here, welcome. Thank you for joining us. This is our last episode of the year. Exam season is finally upon us, so we're signing off for a little while. We might be back in September. And for the first time, it's just me today because Hasti has a job interview, which I hope goes well. But we're getting into something today that doesn't really get enough attention when talking about startups. And it's the more legal and structural side of building a company, from my understanding, and how governance in the early stages can really shape the fate of a startup and a founder's business. And we have a guest who I think is really well positioned to help us unpack this. So, Jonathan, do you think you'd like to introduce yourself? Because I think your background really speaks for itself.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry that Hasti isn't with us today, but very excited for our conversation. Look, my background is I was a practicing lawyer for, gosh, now it's, I'll date myself, but now it's, 26, 27 years. I was a partner at major international law firms for over a decade. With that background, I thought, having represented institutional capital, investment banks, and really seeing the way that capital gets deployed and risk gets analyzed from that perspective, I left the practice of law and set up my own firm. And then for the first time, encountered kind of the governance dynamics that I never had to think about as a finance partner in a law firm. By 2023, I was no longer with the firm that I had founded. And so the experience of kind of navigating all that stuff led me to writing a book, which is what we'll talk about. Yeah. It's really meant to help founders and investors see the blind spots to building ventures. So that's kind of a background to me, a little bit of the background of the book.
But Thank you for that introduction. I think probably this, the rest of the episode in this conversation will, show rather than tell what led you to writing the book as well. And maybe before we get into the bigger questions, I'm aware that sometimes, even when I was preparing for this and researching, that some of the language around this can feel a bit opaque for, students who might be listening to us who aren't founders or investors themselves. So could we maybe start with just explaining what you mean by governance in the context of a startup? And then maybe after that, also clarifying what institutional capital means.
So first about, governance. When I talk about governance, I'm talking about the boards that actually operate and run businesses. I'm talking about the types of decisions that boards are authorized to make. We're talking about voting rights. We're talking about protections that are built into the businesses, actual governing documents. It's the documentation that founders enter into when they take on capital, effectively, is the governance that I'm referring to. And you asked me a second question to that,
The second question will probably take up a bit more time answering that, but just because the phrase institutional capital comes up quite a bit, and why that matters, and what exactly it is.
So institutional capital is the capital that's managed on behalf of others. So if you think about it in the fund community, venture funds, private equity, pensions, sovereigns, the defining characteristic is fiduciary responsibility. So it's kind of the obligations you have to others.
Yep.
It's not individuals deploying their own money. So that's the real distinction. Mm-hmm. But rather, these are entities that are managing portfolios on behalf of limited partners who then have their own return expectations, liquidity requirements, and life cycle constraints. So that's what when we talk about institutional capital, mm-hmm. that's who we're talking about. It's actually important to point out, you know, everything I talk about, on the one hand, people could think, oh, well, is this paranoid and I should never touch institutional capital? And that's absolutely not the case. In fact, institutional capital has built some of the biggest and most exciting businesses. It's all about going into that experience with one's eyes open, mm-hmm. which is the point of the book.
Yeah. So then one might say that what's needed when taking on institutional capital in an investment into a startup, that the founders should maybe be able to like scrutinize the terms more closely than they would in another sort of investment. And what do you think of the sort of provisions that founders just generally don't scrutinize closely enough? If you could give some examples.
Well, I think what I'd say is a particular question I think that they should ask, which is what happens if things don't go according to plan? I think founders get very much into the optimistic scenario. You know, what's going to happen if everything goes right? What if my product hits, my timing hits, my team is perfect? But I would want them, and a lot of them don't, focus not on the optimistic scenario, the scenario where you need emergency capital and your investors have competing priorities, the scenario where one board member wants to have a sale and others don't, the scenario where you miss a quarter of a board-approved plan. Those are the situations where governance structures are actually designed for. And most founders negotiate them in the context of this upside scenario, and they should negotiate them from the context of the downside. So like specifically, right, who makes decisions when cash is tight? What triggers board escalation? How are disagreements about strategy resolved? Decide that when everyone's friendly and happy, because when pressure hits, you can't design anything clearly enough, you know? So that's, probably a good place to start answering that question.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's a good place to maybe jump to the first question, which is maybe a slightly provocative place to start, but when people talk about what makes a startup succeed or fail, it's usually about, you know, what people tend to focus on is the product, the team, the timing, whether there was a gap in the market, and there isn't so much of a focus, at least in everyday discussions, about the governance structures. So from your perspective and what you've seen, how much of a company's fate, whether a startup will succeed, is based on what's already been decided on paper before any of the other stuff to do with their product and their team plays out? What would you say?
Innovation determines whether a company succeeds in the market, absolutely. But governance determines who controls it when it does.
Mm-hmm.
So the key decisions are made super early, as we were talking about before, board composition, voting rights, investor protections. And those things feel really minor and of little consequence at the time, because everybody's aligned at that stage, right? Everyone wants the same near-term outcome. But those structures remain in place and become decisive when pressure enters the system. And the data on this stuff is really instructive. I talk about this one statistic over and over, but to me, it's so fascinating. Maybe only to me, but I think all founders should find it fascinating. Kaplan, Sensory, and Stromberg, in the Journal of Finance, found that 55.6% of all venture-backed CEOs are replaced by year four, and not primarily because their businesses had failed, but because the governance architecture had matured around them and the contractual mechanisms activated. So when we talk about, governance and innovation and what matters more, well, actually, they both matter, but they operate on different time scales, right? Like innovation is the present. Governance is the future, right? So I think that's the way I look at how those two intersect.
That was really interesting, actually, when you mentioned the statistic, because I think up until this point in our discussion, we hadn't really made a distinction between, the actual business failing or a startup failing and the founder losing control. Which do you feel like that's the greater risk that's often not accounted for?
What's really interesting, if you think about what they teach in business school, right? It's all about the all of those things we talk about: product timing, market timing, hiring, firing, all the operational stuff. All the operational stuff that is visible, that if you are a founder that is intelligent, intelligence and reason can really work out those operating issues. The bit that I think is missing, the bit that doesn't really get focused on, is the structural risk. And that structural risk really is about who will ultimately control the business. So this is the thing. It's not so much whether or not the business will succeed or fail, but ultimately who's controlling that business when it succeeds and fails. There have been, as I pointed out with that one statistic, maybe put it a different way. The founders think if they build a successful business, they will always be the one operating it. And that's the issue that isn't the case. And so businesses can continue to be successful, but the people who are operating them may not be,
Yeah,
right?
that
It's
makes
a, there
sense.
is a distinction that you're appropriately making.
And I mean, you've already touched on this quite a bit, but our second question for you, Jonathan, was why do founders miss this so often? And as most people are aware, it's probably not because founders are generally unsophisticated. A lot of them are incredibly intelligent, smart people. So what would you say is going on?
Well, I think there are three reasons, and none of them are about sophistication. So the first is the gratitude trap. It's when someone finally says yes to your vision, after rejection, after uncertainty, it becomes very hard to negotiate for protections you hope you will never need. You're signing out of gratitude, not protection. And gratitude is not a reliable guide to structural decision making, right? The second is the intelligence paradox. It's many, many founders think, I'm smart. I have good advisors. This will never happen to me. But the smarter you are, the better you are at explaining away the warning signs. Intelligence can generate overconfidence about one's ability to read the room. And then the third is something I call it institutional asymmetry. Think about the first-time founder or most founders. Your investors have done 50, 100 deals. The founder's done one, two, none. Investors have playbooks. Founders have optimism. You know, you don't even know the game has started and it's already there. So those are really, for me, the three primary reasons why founders miss these blind spots.
Thank you. That was really well worded. And something that I wanted to, I just picked up on, I don't know if this maybe related to the third with the institutional asymmetry, but could you maybe argue there's also like a systemic problem with incentive and the fact that everyone in the room, when those early decisions are being made, you know, as the founder, you just want the money so that you can continue with your, with your business so you can get started. With for the investor, they just want the deal and they do have experience and make, as a as someone with institutional capital, they have made many deals already. And the lawyers who are present in the room, you know, they're working, that trying to get as many billable hours as possible. There isn't really anyone who has any sort of incentive to slow down and scrutinize and ask those questions. Do you think that dynamic also shapes this lack of, you know, accounting for the worst case scenario?
I think it's true that founders are in an optimistic, fast-moving environment mm-hmm. when these decisions get made. And so the structures feel to them like formalities. I guess the reason that I'm highlighting these issues and trying to start a real discussion around founders' protections and investor alignment mm-hmm. is that, you know, these formalities that feel so inconsequential amongst all the happy moments of signing, yeah. Ultimately the real test comes later, when the environment changes and those formalities activate. And, you know, I guess what I'd say is, while lawyers and the law can be instructive and helpful and should be having the discussion mm-hmm. with their clients about the issues and protections, there is a lawyer paradox that gets caught up in that intelligence paradox. Yeah. It's that when you're a founder and you go out and bring in a lawyer, that lawyer technically represents the company.
Yeah.
And in the early stages, the company is the founder. But once capital comes in, if there's a question about interpretation or protections or an understanding about what those provisions say, who do you think the lawyers are going to be advising at that point?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's when the founder will realize that the lawyers represent the company. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it will likely be the capital that's speaking.
Yeah.
So it is a sub paradox to the intelligence paradox.
Thank you. That's really interesting. If you were giving advice to someone who's, you know, in the middle of raising funds right now, what do you think, what part of that process do you think they'd be most at risk of glossing over something that they shouldn't be, that they should be taking a lot more seriously?
Well, it's interesting. It kind of goes back to some of the things that we talked about earlier, but it's mm-hmm. board composition and how it changes at each funding round.
Yeah.
Decision rights, what requires investor consent, what does not, and investor protection provisions and the conditions that trigger them. So like none of it is like super exotic and exciting, mm-hmm. But it's all in the documents. And most founders just don't read those sections carefully yeah. at the time that they're signing. It's really easy to gloss over stuff that you think is for somebody else, you know, but what I would urge is because those are the formalities that you will live with for the extent of your business, they're essential.
Yeah.
I look at this whole governance and analysis of the governance really as a understanding governance architecture as an asset. It's not a thing for the lawyers to yeah. worry about, in other words.
No, that's very true. I think it's presented sometimes it's just, a formality or like a dry, boring part of, especially if you're a founder and you're driven by, the main thing that you're passionate on, you're actually building something. You want to focus on the innovation side of things. You might not see it as necessary to your business as it actually is. And this is a bit of a different question now. Why do you think that it was you who wrote this book? And, why now? Is there anything specific, do you think, about the way maybe changes in the sort of startups that we're seeing and why it's become clear to you at this moment that, legal frameworks and governance structures within businesses aren't fit to protect them in the future? Or is this something that, throughout your years of experience, working as a lawyer, for example, that you'd always spotted this pattern and it's, culminated in your work in this book? Or is it very specific to this moment?
What I'd say is that when I was no longer working with the firm that I founded, I began consulting for a number of different businesses and entrepreneurs. And I would discuss my story, my experience, and I kept hearing back the same story. Different industries, different businesses with the same result. Founders that were losing their roles, often where the businesses themselves hadn't been failing. That's when I realized it wasn't personal, it was systemic. And so I interviewed founders and I talked to investors and I did the research and I extracted these lessons. For me, I wanted to help other founders avoid experiencing what I had experienced by showing them the patterns before they strike. But it's about pattern recognition. It isn't that things have changed. It isn't that the provisions are getting worse and worse. It's that the provisions work exactly like they're supposed to work. It's about understanding the patterns in advance and being aware so that you as the founder can take the necessary steps to insulate yourself when those provisions activate as designed.
Yeah, I think maybe a follow-up question would be, do you think, it's about pattern recognition and but up until now, the same patterns have been reproducing themselves and have been, consistent in different sectors. A lot of people have the same lived experience. Do you think that a part of the reason why this pattern hasn't really been broken so far is that when founders lose control, they're not able to look back and think like it's because I didn't from step one have a strong foundation with my governance structure and that's how I've ended up in this position? Or do you think they're able to reflect and to see that was where things went wrong?
I think most founders would agree that when they build a business, their identity gets wrapped up in the business. So when that founder or that CEO loses their role, it is an absolute shock to their system, to their self-identity. I think it's incredibly hard at that moment to look at that situation and think, wow, that's systemic. Yep. At that moment, everything feels intensely personal. Mm-hmm. When every person that they have had a professional relationship suddenly doesn't answer their phone call, suddenly doesn't talk to them because they are no longer serving a professional utility for their network, founders feel lost, alone, and completely lacking self-worth. So I can tell you that I don't think founders really get into an understanding of the systemic nature of the pattern recognition until after the fact, when they do kind of what I did, which was talking to other founders and other CEOs that had similar experiences. I think peer-to-peer networks are super valuable for understanding shared experience. But a lot of founders report and told me, you know, they heard the garage to IPO story over and over and over again. But nobody talked to them about the issues and problems along the way. And when I was fortunate enough to talk to so many founders and hear the stories and the same stories and able to do the research, you know, look, there's something wrong if more than half of all CEOs are replaced within 4 years. And to me, that's a conversation that founders need to be having. So, that's why I wrote the book. So we can really have that discussion. I think with investors having a playbook, I wanted to offer founders a playbook and try to make it a more even discussion.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Is there anything that you feel we haven't covered that's central to what the book is about or what led you to write the book?
I think maybe it's worth highlighting kind of like the central idea of the book. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, the central idea is really that the most significant risks founders face are not the ones they typically spend their time managing.
Yeah.
Right. And as I said, founders are excellent at operational problem solving. All those things about product risk and hiring and execution, right? All those things that respond to intelligence and effort, but structural risks are different and they develop slowly and they are invisible by design. They feel harmless in good times and then become decisive in bad times. And they're embedded in the governance and incentive structures that were agreed under entirely different scenarios. So the paradox is really this: the better the company does, the more traction, the more capital, the more momentum, the more structural exposure it accumulates.
Yeah.
And I talk about this, that success creates dependencies. Mm-hmm. Dependencies effectively vulnerabilities. Growth creates cash pressure. Momentum creates urgency. And all of that leads to signing things in good conditions that only activate in bad. So I think is the central point of the book.
Yeah.
And really, there's a lot of value around that for founders and investors.
I think that was a really concise summary. So thank you. Maybe one question that I had actually was, when you take all of this into consideration, do you think that the only people who are realistically equipped to, you know, in the early stages, be proactive and to protect themselves and their business are the founders? Because when we were discussing incentives, do you think that, you know, it can't come from the lawyers in the room or anyone else? It has to be the founders themselves who are who, after reading your book, hopefully know which blind spots to look for, what to question.
Well, look, I'd like it if everybody was focused on protecting founders, but everybody will have their own agendas.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my hope is that founders can appreciate the protections. But at the same time, I'd love it for advisors to be reading this book. I'd love for investors to be reading this book. I think that advisors that understand the issues that founders face should do a better job advising founders around those structural issues. I think investors benefit from this book because they can see what founders go through, right? It's not that founders are evil. In fact, it's the opposite. It's that founders and investors believe they're aligned. The challenge is the documentation they put in place evolves over time in ways that neither side fully anticipates. So I think the my hope is that the book will help investors see why founders go down a certain path. And greater transparency between the two communities is what I hope can develop through having conversations that are begun because of the book.
Thank you. It's been a really brilliant conversation and a great episode for us to end the year on as well. And I think the big takeaway after talking to you for me is that, you know, the governance structures within a company and those very early decisions, they're not just background noise. And it's very important for founders to be aware of that, as well as everyone else who's involved in the process, like advisors, investors. And I think it's great that you've written this book and you've drawn attention to it. If people who are listening to this want to find you or like go deeper into anything that we've discussed today, apart from the book, where else should they go?
Well, I mean, I guess LinkedIn, Substack. I write deeper topics around these issues on Substack every week. And LinkedIn, or obviously the book is available on Amazon. So
wonderful. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Thank you, everyone, for listening. It really means a lot to us. And we'll see you in September.